Evening, buyer's remorse. Buy a new car? I'll be moving in. Let's get started.
Sorry, I think there's been a mistake. I bought it from Carvana.
You what?
Yeah, great price. I even have 7 days to love it or return it.
So there's no...
No buyer's remorse. More like buyer's rejoice.
I guess I'll let myself out. Congratulations. I mean it.
Buyer's rejoice. Buy your car today on Carvana.
Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Jesse Butler was facing 84 years in prison for the 11 felony counts against him, and today he walked out of court completely free with no prison time.
The teenage girl needed surgery to repair the damage done to her neck. Police later found that video on Jesse Mack Butler's phone.
He was initially arrested on March 4th, 2025, and charged with strangulation and several other charges.
The DA's office struck a deal with Butler's lawyers to change his status from adult to youthful offender.
One of his victims actually had to have surgery to repair her windpipe. And on top of all of that, in the middle of everything, he violated a protection order for those victims. At the last minute, the judge and the DA got together and offered Jesse the youthful offender program, despite the severity of the things he was charged with.
The victim's families begged the DA, please do not do that. The judge decided to sign off on this. He knew there was ample evidence to convict him, but as a youthful offender, Jesse Mack Butler was also entitled to special treatment.
So he pleaded no contest to all 11 of those charges and got counseling, weekly phone check-ins, and 150 hours of community service. Today, the judge said that he successfully completed that program with no violations. Therefore, he is a free man, or whatever you want to call him. What's even worse, after the judge stated that he was released from the youthful offender program, his attorney asked to address the court and spoke for quite some time. He portrayed Jesse as innocent and tried to make him look like the victim in all of this. He even suggested that Jesse had suffered more than his victims, and he praised him for showing grace to them. He described today as a big day for Jesse Butler because he now has his whole life ahead of him. Never has to register, and he can basically go and do whatever he wants to. If he wanted to move to another state and change his name, he could. Attorney Rachel Bussett, who represents the victims, the actual victims in this case, also spoke and said that it was completely out of context for Jesse's attorney to speak the way he did. She said it surpassed normal advocacy for a client. She also said, quote, "Let me be clear, you cannot consent to strangulation," end quote. She also said that the DA seemed to be caught off guard and that almost everyone in the court was surprised by the statements that he was making. And let's not forget that these two victims are the ones that actually have to live with this experience for the rest of their lives. Jeremiah Gregory was sworn in as the district attorney in July 31st, 2026 for Payne County. And he attended today as an observer, but after Jesse's attorney spoke, he stood and asked to speak as well. He called Derek Chance's presentation garbage. And I would have to say that I completely agree. Because not only did Jesse essentially get away with what he did in this county, but to have the audacity to stand up there and try and victimize the villain is absurd. At the very least, since he didn't have any real consequences for what he did, what they could have done was stand up there and apologize and show real remorse and real feelings for what happened. The new district attorney also explained that Oklahoma cannot prosecute Jesse Butler again because of double jeopardy. However, he did announce that his office will be submitting this case for a federal review, stating that the federal government is separate and that they do have an opportunity here to try and make this right. So at this point, Jesse has completed the youthful offender program. He's not going to be transferred to adult court, and he's essentially free. And what happened with this case and what happened in Oklahoma is an absolute failure of the justice system.
911, what is your emergency?
Hello? Oh, it's a baby.
A couple in Florida is suing the city of Coral Springs after they say that a deputy initiated and continued a pursuit that caused the death of their six-year-old.
The six-year-old was riding home with her great-grandmother when investigators say a driver fleeing an attempted traffic stop slammed into their SUV.
Even though the policy states that deputies are not to initiate pursuits when it comes to traffic-related offenses. This is 6-year-old Harlow, and her life ended on May the 5th, 2024. After a white Mercedes that was fleeing a traffic stop slammed into the vehicle that she was riding in with her great-grandmother. The driver of that Mercedes was arrested, and that case remains unresolved as well. But Harlow's parents, Danny and Samari, are suing the city, claiming that Officer John Dedino continued pursuing this Mercedes, even though that's against policy.
Her parents, Samari Curbelo and Danny Tran, are now suing the city of Coral Springs, alleging Officer John Dedino began a dangerous pursuit over dark window tints.
The city denies that there was a pursuit and maintains that Dedino was following policy, but I'm going to insert video here and let you evaluate that for yourself. At approximately 5:06 p.m. on May the 5th, 2024, Officer Dedino spotted this Mercedes and attempted to pull it over because of its dark tint. When Dedino turned on his lights and sirens, Graham, the driver of the Mercedes, instead accelerated and started to switch lanes instead of stopping. Dedino says that as soon as the Mercedes fled, he turned his lights and sirens off and slowed almost completely to a stop. And the city says that this is evidence that he abandoned the traffic stop. However, video footage shows that Mercedes at 107 miles per hour before making impact with Harlow's car. It also shows Officer Dedino following behind and arriving on scene 3 seconds after this impact occurred. Harlow's great-grandmother was attempting to turn north in their SUV when this Mercedes struck them at 107 miles per hour. 6-year-old Harlow was launched from the back of the vehicle while still attached to her car seat. She was airlifted for medical assistance, and she did die in hospital care. Harlow's great-grandmother did survive, but with substantial injuries, and this Mercedes also hit 2 other parked vehicles. Siobhan Graham, the driver of the Mercedes, was arrested, and that case does still remain in the courts. The family filed this lawsuit against the city on April the 7th, 2026. And there's this back and forth of the family stating that this was a pursuit and the officer in the city stating that it was not. There was an eyewitness from that day named Manuel Sayago who told investigators that he saw the Mercedes fleeing and he saw a police officer following behind him. The only thing he didn't see were the police officer's lights turned on. He said they were off. He specifically told investigators that he saw a police officer chasing the Mercedes and then heard the impact. The city has also tried to rebuttal and say that Harlow was not secured properly, but they have officer statements, written statements, that they had to use a seatbelt cutter to remove her, as she was strapped into her car seat and she and the car seat were ejected. And body cam from that day has been released, but Dedino's own body cam has not. There actually was no internal affairs investigation after all of this happened, and Dedino was named Officer of the Year for his service that year. Harlow Tran was born in Miami on July 9th, 2017. She attended school and dance classes in Coral Springs, Florida. She loved dancing, music, Disney, Pokemon Go, Mario Kart. She also loved face painting and swimming like a mermaid. She would have turned 7 2 months after this incident, and she had asked to visit New York for her 7th birthday.
I'm joyful,
This case is heartbreaking for Harlow and her family, and no amount of money would ever change that. But I do hope that the best outcome possible is reached for her family's sake. A dad in Grove City, Ohio, posed as his 11-year-old daughter on TikTok to lure her abuser to their home. Mind you, this guy is 20, and he actually showed up. So the father shot him. So this all started on July 15, 2026, when this child's mother found a video on her 11-year-old daughter's phone of her being raped by this 20-year-old man. What's even worse is that the video was taken inside their own home, and police began investigating that night. The next day, on July 16th, at around 6:09 p.m., this 11-year-old's dad, Malik Chandler, started communicating online, pretending to be her on TikTok. He invited Diego to come back over to their apartment, and Diego came because he thought it was the 11-year-old he was talking to. So Malik told police that his plan was, once Diego got there, he was just going to confront him, possibly fight him, and then call police while he held him for them to come get him. But he says once he asked Diego who he was, Diego started reaching into his pocket, and he thought that he might be getting a gun. So Malik grabbed him and shot him 2 times. Malik immediately called police, and when they got there, they found Diego in a chair. They took him to the hospital, and he is fine. He survived what happened. They did arrest Malik Chandler and charge him with shooting Diego, but they also have arrested Diego Gonzalez. He's been charged with, but investigators say that once they took his phone and started looking at it, they found so much more on there, so many other victims. They also found material going all the way down to the age of an infant or a toddler. So now this predator is off the street, and both of these men are in jail waiting for the next step.
Evening. Buyer's remorse. Buy a new car? I'll be moving in. Let's get started.
Sorry, I think there's been a mistake. I bought it from Carvana.
You what?
Yeah, great price. I even have 7 days to love it or return it.
So there's no...
No buyer's remorse. More like buyer's rejoice.
I guess I'll let myself out. Congratulations. I mean it.
Buyer's rejoice. Buy your car today on Carvana. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
To the families and loved ones of Dustin and Samson, we recognize the tremendous loss they're experiencing, and our prayers remain with them during this incredibly difficult time.
Two childhood friends met back up in their hometown for one of them to grieve the loss of their family pet of 8 years and spread the ashes, and one of them was just there for support. But now, they're both dead. Their names are Samson Campbell, who was 18, and Dustin Rose, who was 19. They were both from DeLand, Florida, but Samson had actually moved to the Chicago area in 2025. And Samson's father still lived in the DeLand area and notified him of the loss of the family pet. So he decided to come back home, grieve the loss, and spread the ashes. Dustin grew up in DeLeon Springs, but had moved to South Carolina and was attending the Citadel. He was also a private first class in the South Carolina Army National Guard. He was on a break from school, so he went down to DeLand to support his childhood friend, Samson. On July 28, 2026, at around 6 p.m., surveillance footage caught Dustin and Samson walking together. Police say that they were meeting 17-year-old Keon Rundell in a vacant parking lot, and they haven't stated yet exactly why they were meeting or what their relation is to Keon. At some point during that meeting, police alleged that Keon shot both Dustin and Samson and then fled the scene. On Wednesday, July 29th, after they hadn't responded to any phone calls, one of the boys' mom tracked their phone to that vacant lot and found them there. Police were called at about 10:40 p.m. on July 29th, and they discovered that both boys had been shot several times. They were pronounced on scene, and police say that they had been there for several hours. Detectives were able to use that surveillance footage to actually identify Keon Rundell, and when they searched his property, they found several objects that were incriminating. On Saturday, August 1st, they found clothing that they believe he wore during all of this, and a bike that they believe he fled the scene on. However, he was not there, and they were not able to locate him, so they did get a warrant for his arrest, and on August the 4th, they publicly identified him in hopes that someone would know where he was. This morning, August 5th, 2026, he was located at a hotel in Ellenton, Florida, and he was taken in without incident. Police also say that there could be eventually additional suspects if they determine that someone helped him in carrying this out or planning it. And what still remains unknown is the motive, exactly how these boys knew each other and exactly why this all happened. And Dustin and Samson's families are completely devastated at their loss. Two very young childhood friends went to their hometown to do something that was already going to be hard, grieving the loss of a family pet of 8 years, spreading the ashes and processing all of that. And then for this to happen on top of all of that is completely devastating. And the suspect is only 17 years old, which is incredibly young to have done something like this. This story is just heartbreaking all the way around.
A just trial for my daughter. She deserves that. It's not just about Maddie, but it's about every victim.
This 19-year-old LSU student was raped by two boys in the back of a car and then put out of the car so disoriented that she walked into traffic, was hit by a car, and died. Trial in the Madison Brooks case hasn't even started yet, and there's already been so much controversy around the courtroom. Today, the judge decided that her supporters can wear pink in the courtroom, even though that was being challenged. And that same judge, there's already been an attempt made to remove her from the bench for this trial because her son has convictions. I want to talk about Madison's story and what happened to her, and then explain the pink ruling and the judge's situation. Madison Brooks was only 19 years old, and she was a student at the Louisiana State University. On the early morning of January 15, 2023, she left Reggie's Bar in Baton Rouge's Tigerland District with four boys. According to the arrest documents, she had asked them for a ride, and she was visibly intoxicated, slurring her words, couldn't really stand, and just needed a way home. Those boys were Desmond Carter, Kayvon Washington, Kason Carver, and Everett Lee. Investigators say that Carter and Washington were in the backseat with Madison, and that's where the SA happened. Carver was allegedly driving, and Lee was allegedly in the passenger seat. The group then dropped her out and left her near the Pelican Lakes subdivision. And police reports show that her blood alcohol level was 0.319. She was severely intoxicated. Less than an hour later, she was struck by a rideshare vehicle in the highway. She was taken to a hospital and she died. Desmond Carter is up first, and his trial starts on August the 17th. And his attorney is the one who requested that no one be able to wear pink in the courtroom, even though that was Madison's favorite color. And her supporters feel like that's what they should be wearing in the courtroom. He says that it could influence the jury to make decisions that they wouldn't otherwise make. Pink is also the color associated with the Madison Brooks Foundation, which was founded by her mother. Today, August 6, 2026, Judge Gail Ray Horn denied that blanket ban and said that her supporters can most definitely wear pink. She did, however, say that Madison's picture cannot be in the room, no one can wear clothing with her photo on it, buttons, pens, anything like that. Desmond Carter was 17 when this all happened, but he is being tried as an adult for the severity of the things that happened. Kayvon Washington was indicted on charges and for videoing, but at this time, no court date has been set for him. There are also other cases where he's facing SA allegations and other victims. Kason Carver has also been indicted for and videoing, and at this time, his court date is set for November 16th. Everett Lee was arrested as a principal to this raid, but the grand jury decided that he would not be indicted. Now, let's talk about why Judge Ray was challenged in this case. Text messages were recovered between Carver and his father, where he specifically stated that Judge Ray's son had been convicted of rape and that she would know how to help them. And it's true, her son, Nelson Taylor, who is 46 now, was involved in a series of attacks on different women and was charged with 3 counts of rape. And she was actually recused in November 2025. However, that removal was reversed on May the 30th, 2026, placing Ray back in charge of Carver's case. Madison Kennedy Brooks was born on May the 7th, 2003, and grew up in Covington, Louisiana. She was only 19 years old and a sophomore at LSU. She had recently been accepted into the school's Manship School of Mass Communication, and in high school, she was an honor roll student and a cheerleader. Her family said she loved beach days, shopping, and football nights with her family. Pink really was her favorite color, and she included it in every way that she possibly could. One of the most powerful details is that Madison was also an organ donor. As her final act of kindness, her heart and kidneys were donated after her death to save lives. As these trials begin, Madison deserves to be remembered for the full life she lived and the full life she could have had. Today, August 6, 2026, LSU issued a statement that Jesse Mack Butler is not enrolled at their university. Because yesterday, August 5th, there were some posts floating around on social media that Jesse was planning to go there or already enrolled there, and some of the parents said that they were going to be calling the university to complain.
I mentioned there were 10 counts before. By August, there was one more. Now stood at 11. The new count was for violating a protective order. Facing 10 felony counts and violating a protective order should have been a hell of a red flag for anybody.
In a post on their Facebook page, LSU said, "We are aware of social media posts circulating that alleges LSU has admitted an individual convicted of a violent sexual offense. This claim is false. LSU has no record of this individual in our admission system, nor do we have any indication that the individual plans to enroll or attend the university. We encourage the public to rely on verified information and refrain from sharing misinformation." Now, here's the thing. Could Jesse have said that he wanted to go to LSU in the future, or was he planning to enroll? Absolutely, he could have. That's the reality of this situation that everyone should be so upset about. What Jesse did was awful. He was facing 11 felony counts and he had more than one victim. So this is a pattern of his behavior. And he was facing significant prison time. But because he was allowed to go through the youthful offender program at the very last minute, now his remaining state case has been dismissed. He completed the program per the judge and he is completely free. And his lawyer said that he will be seeking expungement, which means that all of these things won't show on his record at all. So if he wants to go apply to any university, he can, and they won't see these things on his record. If he wants to establish residence in another county and change his name, he can. Because the court system failed, he now has the ability to do all of those things. And if he goes to another state, to a university, and changes his name or keeps a low profile, he will probably interact with females who have no idea who he is. That is scary, and families have the right to know if they are sending their kids to school every day with someone who has done such things. And why do I think LSU was brought up? Because Jesse's dad has a significant history there. In 2005, he was appointed the assistant athletic director for the LSU football program. And he was there for 3 years, including 2007 when they won the BCS National Championship. When he left there, that's when he returned to Oklahoma State University as the director of the football operations. So he has history there, probably friends there, people that he knows, and it makes sense why LSU would be brought up. So if I were living in that area and I knew someone that I cared about that were going to LSU, I would make sure that they know that this is a possibility. And I would make sure that they know what he looks like because he might not go by the same name. At this time, LSU says he's not enrolled there, and we'll see how that plays out. But the reality is, he is a free man, and the possibility that he will end up at a university somewhere is very...
Queen Carvania stood haloed by the morning sun. An army hung on her every word.
My champions, I have sold my chariot on Carvana. 'Twas a lovely SUV, an inexplicably queenly offer. They're even coming to the castle to collect it. Tonight, we feast.
An offer you can feast on. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Very real. Today is August the 7th, 2026, and there is even more new Jesse Butler news. There's a new civil lawsuit being prepared by one of the victims, and I'm going to tell you all about it. If you're new here, because we do have a lot of new friends, my name's Dana, and I'm a certified victims advocate with primary experience in a crisis center. I've worked with all different types of victims, and I got that certification and that job after going through the courts with my own case. I had an advocate who changed my life, and I want that for everyone else. Okay, today, Rachel Bussett, who is representing the victims in the Jesse Butler case, made an announcement that she is preparing a civil lawsuit against Jesse for one of the victims. She says it'll be filed early next week, and they haven't completely decided exactly which claims will be pursued in this lawsuit. She did give us some hints, however. She said that the plea agreements are going to be a big factual part of this case and in the calculation of damages caused by all of this. She did mention Jesse's Office of Juvenile Affairs records and said that she would be pursuing discovery that would include that, which means she would be trying to get documentation that gives her more information about his records. She mentioned the liability and responsibility of schools, family members, and other people around this case, and what happens when people know about abuse and fail to act. And if you guys remember, the other victim's family has already filed a civil lawsuit. That was back in December of 2025. And in that lawsuit, they didn't just mention Jesse. They mentioned his parents, the schools, the city, and the school resource officer. They say that Jesse's parents knew about some of this behavior and failed to act. And if you remember, way back when this all first started, in the police report, it says that Jesse's mom knocked on the door because she heard something concerning and he told her to go away, and she did. I'm going to be keeping a close eye on the discovery and all of the information that's going to come out in these civil lawsuits, because I think there's a whole lot more to the story. And here's the thing that has me so upset this morning. The court system failed to protect the victims in the way that it should. So now they're having to pursue their own civil lawsuits to get any form of justice out of this. And I know from personal experience, they're going to have a huge therapy bill and years spent trying to navigate the trauma that this has caused them. Honestly, it is really hard for me to read some of the police reports that I do in doing this work that we do. But I do it because I know it's important for people to know that these things happen. Advocacy and awareness is so important. So I read the Jesse Butler reports, and I wouldn't suggest that anyone does that without a massive warning. The reports from this case are one of the first ones that actually made me physically sick for hours. So I'm going to spare you all of those details. But what I will say is that one of these victims was 30 seconds from death. And that's confirmed by the doctor who did her surgery to repair her windpipe. In this case, the courts failed, and that's already done. My heart is broken for these two victims who did their best to stand up and try and get justice, and it is so hard to do that. I've spoken with the parents of both of these victims, and all they wanted was for their voice to be heard and for them to get justice. That's why we drove out to Stillwater when all of this started, and that's why we continue to advocate in this case. And there are so many more cases just like this one. There are so many more victims just like these. That's why we started our nonprofit, the Red Flags Rescue Project, and I'm going to put a little bit of information on the screen because if you're in a situation like this and you need help, we are here to help. Our goal is to give everyone a voice, give everyone a way to report directly to someone who is going to have your best interest in mind and who is going to help you. And once these cases are over in the headlines, they're not over for the victims. So that's also a part of what we're doing. We want to help these victims get therapy services and all of the things that they need for their healing journey. Because where they live, the place where the courts failed them in the first place, those funds are limited and they will run out and they will cut off services very quickly. What these two victims have done in this case is so brave. And what I hope for them and for every other victim in the world is that this case opens everyone's eyes to the fact that this happens and makes them angry enough for something to change. We can't go back and change what happened in the court, but what we can do is make sure that everyone knows. In Litchfield Park, Arizona, a welfare check led police to discover two parents in the backyard and their son missing, who is now a suspect. On Tuesday, August 4th, 2026, relatives contacted police because they were concerned because they couldn't get a hold of the family, which consisted of two adults and then their adult son. When police arrived at the home near Litchfield Road and Wigwam Boulevard, they couldn't find any of the family members. But what they found inside changed everything because they found blood everywhere and it looked like someone had tried to clean up the scene. When they started searching around and made it to the backyard, they found the bodies of the two adult parents in the backyard. They were in a state of decomposition, but they can't say exactly how long they had been there. It's important to note that these two bodies haven't been publicly identified yet because they're waiting for all of their testing to come back. So we don't have photos and names just yet. But we do know that the son's name is Matthew Flores and he's 27 and police are now searching for him as he is their prime suspect. They also believe that he's fled the country. So there's an international search underway looking for this man. The U.S. Marshals are also now involved and they're using everything they can to try and locate him. Police still don't have an exact timeline, but one of the neighbors said that on August the 3rd, they were walking near the family's home and they heard yelling or an altercation. They heard someone saying, "Please stop." This case is pretty fresh and there are a lot of unanswered questions, but at this time, authorities are asking for anyone with any information that can help them locate Matthew Flores to please come forward. In North Dakota, a 22-year-old mom has taken the lives of two of her children. And a third child has survived, but has been undergoing surgery. Her name is Kaylee Earhart. She's 22 years old and from Mandan, North Dakota. She was arrested on August 6, 2026, after police responded to their family home on Frontier Trail. Police allege that she attacked her three children, and her five-month-old and three-year-old did not survive. Her one-year-old did survive, but has been in the hospital undergoing surgery. According to the children's father, he and Earhart were in the process of separating, and he was planning to divorce her. He told police that she had talked about taking her own life before and taking the lives of their three children. He says that she had recently purchased a gun and on the night of August 6th, she had attempted to use it against him, but he was able to get it away from her through a little bit of a struggle and take it apart and put it through all throughout the house in several different pieces. He turned in video evidence of the struggle over this and him trying to disassemble it and get it away from her. And in some of the videos, she had one of the kids in her arms while also having this gun in her hand and telling him to say goodbye to his kids. The children's grandmother was there as well. And after he took this gun away from her, she grabbed a knife from the kitchen and chased him and the grandmother out of the house and locked the door. At that time, all three of the children were still inside the house. So their dad called 911 to let them know their mom was threatening to harm them and that she had locked herself inside the house with the kids. When police got there at 5:42 p.m., she had already used that knife on all three kids and was holding it to herself. Police say she was covered in blood. When they told her to drop the knife, she did, and they followed the blood trail back to a bedroom where they found all three children on a bed. She had already used it on all of their necks, and even though they were transported to the hospital, the three-year-old and the five-month-old did not survive. The one-year-old somehow did survive and is clinging on to life. After police advised Haley of her Miranda rights, she allegedly told them that she had placed the kids on the bed, but she thought that somehow their throats had already looked that way and that she didn't really remember what happened. And what's so upsetting is that according to the kid's father, he had already notified mental health services and CPS of the threats that Haley had been making. In the last 12 to 18 months, she had been hospitalized for these things that she was saying and the thoughts that she was having. And she'd also been medicated for that and cleared to be around the children. And how traumatizing this all must have been for the father and grandmother who were in the house witnessing parts of this and trying to stop it from happening. Haley has been charged with 2 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder, along with aggravated and domestic violence, and her bail has been set at $3 million cash. And a GoFundMe has been set up by Melissa Earhart, the grandmother, for Cameron Earhart, the father, and the surviving child. This family has been completely shattered in the matter of one evening, and it seems like CPS had been notified. So what happened after the father made those reports? And what exactly happened to clear her to be around the children?
Queen Carvania stood haloed by the morning sun. An army hung on her every word.
My champions, I have sold my chariot on Carvana. 'Twas a lovely SUV, an inexplicably queenly offer. They're even coming to the castle to collect it. Tonight, we feast!
An offer you can feast on. Sell your car today on Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
In Cincinnati, a mother and 2 other women have been arrested after a 7-year-old developmentally disabled boy was found dead in a closet in their home. His name was William Evans, and he lived in Cincinnati's Oakley neighborhood with his mom and 2 other women. His mom's name is Caitlin Evans, and her roommates are Nessa Keeney and Kirby Rankin. At around 1 p.m. on August the 6th, 2026, police were called because Caitlin, the mother, showed up at a nearby urgent care clinic. On the police call, someone from the urgent care clinic said that a barefoot woman was lying on their floor, crying and saying that someone was trying to kill her and that her son had been killed. After responding, police then went to Caitlin's home. And when they went in and walked through the house, they saw the 2 roommates. And as they searched, they found William in one of the closets. They said he was duct taped, had been placed there, and was already dead. All 3 women were arrested, and what they discovered, according to police detective Kyle Smith, is one of the worst cases of child abuse ever seen. They say there was evidence of repeated physical abuse and that he had been beaten, bound, and held underwater even for extended periods of time. He also had several burn injuries from repeated burning over time. Police say that all 3 women were participating in this treatment of William, and all 3 were concealing it. And William's other parent says that he had been kept from them for 9 months, and they hadn't been allowed to see him or talk to him at all. Hamilton County Disability Services also says that they have no record of William in their system, even though he was developmentally disabled. And it appears that he was intentionally isolated so that this behavior could continue to happen. I don't exactly know why Caitlin showed up at the urgent care barefoot saying that someone had kidnapped him, other than to try and come up with some sort of story to cover this all up. But the details of what these 3 women did to this little boy are so disturbing. And William deserves justice for what happened here.
Tonight, a man who'd been living in Tucson is awaiting extradition from Germany after police say he murdered girlfriend.
In Arizona, a 19-year-old who was planning to leave her boyfriend was found dead, and her boyfriend has now been arrested in Germany after he fled the country. Her name was Jalissa Salazar. She was from Yuma, Arizona, but she had been living in Tucson near the University of Arizona. She was living close to campus as a University of Arizona student, and she left behind her parents and 2 younger sisters. Her boyfriend, Varun Bachigari, is 20, and he is also a student at the University of Arizona.
Hi, I'm Varun. I'm a business analytics student at the University of Arizona.
On August 6, 2026, at around 4 p.m., Jalissa's family contacted police to request a welfare check. They hadn't been able to get a hold of her, and when police arrived at her apartment in the 1700 block of North Tyndall Avenue, they found Jalissa deceased. She was found lying on the floor with the blanket pulled all the way up to her neck, but the markings around her neck led police to immediately classify this as suspicious. Police started identifying witnesses and doing interviews, and that's how they determined that her boyfriend was their suspect. One of Jalissa's roommates told police that she had heard yelling coming from Jalissa's room on August the 5th, the night before she had been found. And she told police that she actually texted Jalissa to ask if everything was okay. And she responded saying, yes, everything was fine. So she didn't go in and interrupt her time with her boyfriend. Police are now alleging that it wasn't Jalissa responding to those texts at all. It was actually her boyfriend with her phone. One of Jalissa's roommates also told police that she had been planning to break up with him because she was afraid of him and his outbursts and that he had previously SA'd her. She had even moved in with a friend briefly in 2025, trying to get away from the situation. So this had been something that seems like it was going on for a while. Investigators were also told that the University of Arizona police had handled some of these things that were happening around this boyfriend. They also discovered that Bachigari had recently lost his job and been expelled from the university for his behavior. They also found other witnesses that said they had also been SA'd by this same man. So it seems like he was running around campus doing all kinds of awful things. Police say they were able to track Bachigari because he actually took Julissa's bank cards and used them for some of his transport to get out of the country. They worked with federal agents and they were able to grab him in Germany, but they say that his plan was to continue onward to India. He's been charged with first-degree murder and kidnapping, but police have not explained that kidnapping charge or why it exists. And right now, he's still in Germany awaiting extradition back to the United States. It does make sense that he would be headed to India because that's where he's from, and he was actually in Arizona on a student visa. Julissa's family and friends called her Julie, and they have started a GoFundMe to get her remains moved back from Tucson to Yuma. They want to give her a proper ceremony and remember her for all of the things that she was and all of the things that she could have been. In Rhode Island, a 29-year-old pregnant mother has lost her life to a registered offender who was on probation. Her name was Gabriela Vallejo. She was the mother of a 6-year-old daughter and was currently several months pregnant. She had been living at the Glenark Mills Apartments in Woonsocket with her boyfriend, William Ramos. William is 30 years old and has quite a history in the legal system. Police believe Gabriela was killed sometime between August 3rd and August 4th. And on Tuesday, August 4th, at around 3:41 a.m., Ramos was pulled over driving Gabriela's vehicle, and he actually fled the traffic stop. On Wednesday, August the 5th, Ramos was encountered again at another traffic stop, but as the passenger in a vehicle. And when asked who he was, he gave them false information, but police recognized him and they arrested him. At that time, he was brought into Providence District Court for fleeing that initial traffic stop. And the probation officer notified the judge that he was already on probation for violating a restraining order around Gabriela. The judge still decided that he should be released on a surety bail. And at this time, they didn't even realize that Gabriela was already dead. On Thursday, August 6th, there was finally a welfare check done on Gabriela, and police found her dead with multiple wounds. Police quickly focused in on her boyfriend, William Ramos, and a bolo was issued. He was located at River Island Park, but there was actually an intense pursuit where he went through the water to the other bank, and they finally got him and took him in. He's been charged with Gabriela's murder. He's also been charged with failing to notify them of his address change because he is a registered sex offender. After being taken in and interviewed, he admitted responsibility for Gabriela's death. He told police that he did it. And there was a long history of protection orders, and Gabriela had actually canceled one of those orders against him, which is a common thing that happens in situations of DV. Gabriela's family says that they had never met Ramos and that they didn't realize how much had changed. It's also been confirmed that her 6-year-old daughter was not living in that apartment with her. Accountability belongs to the person responsible for committing the crime, but prevention means that we have to be willing to look at the warning signs. Gabriela was only 29 and she deserved to live the rest of her life.
Evening. Buyer's remorse. Buy a new car? I'll be moving in. Let's get started.
Sorry, I think there's been a mistake. I bought it from Carvana.
You what?
Yeah, great price. I even have 7 days to love it or return it.
So there's no...
No buyer's remorse. More like buyer's rejoice.
I guess I'll let myself out. Congratulations. I mean it.
Buyer's rejoice. Buy your car today on Carvana. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.